All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another virtual event this afternoon. This afternoon, we have Sulari Gentle joining us to discuss her brand new book, Where There's a Will. And what time is it there in Australia? 9:30?
It's 9:30 in the morning. Very civilized.
Wow. Wow. So I will be monitoring the comments field on YouTube and Facebook. So if you have questions for Sulari or Barbara, go ahead and put them in, and Barbara will summon me back on screen towards the end of the hour. So again, here's the beautiful cover right here. And over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm told that I am slightly frozen. So if for some reason I go south, I'm going to disappear and come back on my iPad or something. I hate it when that happens, but my IT consultant, known as my husband, is out for the moment. So let me add that in addition to the gorgeous book, we have signed book plates that have come, all the way from Australia. Wow, how exciting is that? Can you hear me?
Yes, I had this. I can. I only signed them 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, so I'm very impressed with the postal system that seems to be operating despite everything else going on in the world.
You might be interested to know that it doesn't work in the reverse. Our post office is not delivering books to Australia.
No. I have noticed that as I'm waiting for my own copy of Where There's a Will, but it's just one of these things. Hopefully the world will start to get its act together. I think in Australia, because we're having our first really big surge, things like the post office are just grinding to a halt because people aren't coming to work and they're having to isolate for the first time. And I don't think anybody actually thought about what's going to happen when the workers don't turn up.
Well, that's a good point. Of course, Australia has really been in the news recently with its various policies, which I uphold, but it's a tough act to decide what the right thing is to do with a lot of people. But I don't think that famous people should get a pass just because they're famous.
Yep. I think the majority of Australians agree with that. So it's interesting. There are, of course, vested interests and, people who are financially connected or financially invested in famous people arriving in the country, and they will always push back, which is why a lot of the controversy has been in the media. But generally, Australians are fairly socially responsible and fairly law-abiding with respect to all the restrictions that we've been facing, which is probably why to date we've done okay in terms of COVID. But of course, Omicron came along just as we were opening up, and all of a sudden it's just rampaging through the community. And we're having, we're having even deaths in the order of, 50 or 60 a day, which sounds ridiculous to America, but it's something that's really confronting to us because it's not something we've experienced before.
Well, we are actually going to be traveling to Boston with Roland Sinclair and his three bohemian colleagues, Edna the sculptor, Clyde the artist, and Milton the poet, or at least he calls himself a poet, but the truth is his poetry is always quoting other poets, which then Sulari through Roland Sinclair identifies for us, which is sort of part of the fun. But let's go back to Shanghai Secrets, which had a different title when it first came my way, which I personally loved. All the Tears in China, right? A little play
That's right.
On all the tea in China. And anyway, Roland and his three friends, because they traveled as a unit, were sent to Shanghai by Roland's older brother, who really administers the enormous Sinclair wealth and so forth. And Roland gets to be, I don't think a playboy's fair. What would you describe Roland as? How would you describe him?
I would describe him as the youngest son. He is relieved of the responsibility of carrying the the mantle of family patriarch and the responsibility of making sure that the family fortune remains a fortune. And so he is tolerated to be a little bit left of field or a bit more artistic or a bit more scandalous. He would probably say that's his role to scandalize the family, because that is traditionally the role of younger sons, to be the troublesome one. But generally what he has is he has the privilege, and the privilege comes not only from his wealth, but his position as the youngest son and the fact that his elder brother has stepped up. He has the privilege to pursue what he loves and also what he believes in.
And to support his friends who don't have any obvious source of income and seem to feel perfectly free. And it's Roland's, with Roland's permission, to spend Roland's money however they want. So, you know, it means that four of them get to behave like younger sons. But to be real, Sulari, going way back into this series, because this is the 10th book, there was a younger brother. There were originally three. And one of them died.
There was originally, yes, Roland is the youngest, but between Roland and Wilfred, there's 14 years, and also Aubrey Sinclair, who was 9 years Roland's elder and who fell in France. So the family is, despite its vast privilege, it hasn't been untouched by tragedy. So there is that sense of sadness and that sense of, there is always someone missing in the interactions between Wilfred and Roland, because I suspect that Aubrey was the bridge between the two extremes in the fraternal relationship. He sat somewhere between very responsible, very conservative, very austere Wilfred, and quite reckless, emotional, impulsive Roland.
Well, I think that's true, but I also think perhaps that Aubrey's loss made Will even loosen up even more with Roland, having already lost one brother. He's not willing to alienate Roland. But of course, it's hard for a family that's so conservative to really accept not just Roland, but this whole lifestyle, because, you know, they live as a unit in the big house in Sydney. They travel as a unit together. Roland isn't married, doesn't have children, but fortunately Will has, I'm trying to remember, does he have one son or two?
He has three now. three. Gilbert was the most recent born, and I think he was born in book six. Rowley was actually there when the home birth was taking place, which was quite a confronting thing for Roland Sinclair. So Wilfred is your very typical, very conservative family man. But, you know, it's a funny thing. Whilst Wilfred is very economically conservative, socially sometimes he is not as conservative as you expect. He is surprisingly willing to live and let live, to observe his own conservative values, but to accept that other people live in another way. And he's become progressively more so during the series. So in the very first book, he was quite demanding that Roland pull his socks up and stop disgracing the family. And he was quite belligerent and hostile towards Roland's friends. But over the course of 10 novels, I think Wilfred has softened, particularly when he sees how loyal Roland's friends are to him. So in the beginning, you know, Roland's friends did seem like they were malingerers and that they were using him and living off him. But as each story progresses, I think you come to realize that Edna, Clyde, and Milton are as completely loyal to Roland as he is to them. And if they had money, they would share it with him, as they share everything else. So you start to accept what seems to be a very unusual setup in the beginning, because you realize that their relationship is actually two-way.
Well, I think they've achieved what in modern parlance is called a found family. Yes. And it does come back to my point that I think Will is, with the birth of his own children and the various things that have happened, has become, as you say, more tolerant. So in Shanghai Secrets, now the title of All the Tears in China, Will has sent Roland to Shanghai to look after some family interests. And of course, Edna, Clyde, and Milton have gone along. And lucky them, they have been living in Raffles Hotel for 6 months. I want to tell you that I have really serious envy about this. I have always wanted to live in Raffles Hotel, even overnight, Sue Larry. But unfortunately, it doesn't really exist anymore. The hotel that they are in is no longer Raffles Hotel, you know, with the famous bar and the Singapore Sling and all of that. So much of, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but so many institutions of colonial rule have changed, and Raffles is certainly one of them.
Yes, I agree. One of the wonderful things about writing historical fiction is it allows me to visit these places, if only in my imagination. But I, after 10 books, I'm so completely in sync with the way Roland sees the world and Roland's experiences. In some ways, I get to experience Raffles as it was in 1935 through him. And it doesn't, and it's the same for Shanghai. Shanghai isn't what it was in 1935 either. And the historical fiction perhaps is the only way in which you can visit those great places again. Because, you know, history being what it is and the human race being what it is, things have moved on and things have fallen away.
That is so true. If any of you have ever read Tom Bradby's wonderful book, The Rain, which is set in Shanghai in the 1920s, and the Bund comes into play and all, it gives you a great picture of Shanghai. My only visit to Shanghai was in 1997, which was just before the transition of Hong Kong and eventually Macau back to China. And at that point, Sulari, that the island that now looks like downtown Sydney or Manhattan didn't have anything on it. And the premier event during our week in Shanghai, the thing that everybody was so excited about, the Chinese anyway, was it was the opening of the first Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise. And I'm serious. And everywhere you looked, you know, there were banners and ads and all the Chinese are rushing down, you know, to have American fried chicken. And we're all going, really? But, you know, by now, I don't want to go back to Shanghai. I've thought about it because we've had other travel opportunities, but the Shanghai even that I saw in 1997, which let alone 1935, doesn't exist anymore. And I kind of like to keep that. Same thing with Hong Kong. I mean, we were there when the clock was down at the harbor, you know, ticking along for the last, and it wasn't Britain anymore, but it wasn't China yet. And Macau didn't, it had, I mean, it was still Portuguese. It had inns. We had lunch in a Portuguese inn, and we went to visit the sea goddess temple on the coast, which was fabulous. And now you look at Macau and it looks like Las Vegas. And you know, that's an incredible change in what, 24 years? I mean, it's hard to believe.
It's one of those things that the past is a place best revisited in literature and the imagination, because you just can't go there again. And I think that was always something that I knew instinctively because I'm an immigrant. And my parents left Sri Lanka at a certain era, and the Sri Lanka they knew changed in their absence. So when we were children, we were taken back to the island, And what we knew of it were the stories that our parents told us of their experience of Sri Lanka, and it just wasn't there anymore. It wasn't the same place. So from, you know, from the time I was eight, I was very cognizant of the fact that that you lose places, and they may actually physically still exist, but they exist within a time. And once that time is gone, so is that place within the time.
Well, it's absolutely true. Now, one of the other things that I really enjoyed about this book, I pointed out that we, in the previous book, were in Shanghai. They now have to journey to Boston for reasons that Sir Larry can tell you. And I love the fact they are flying on an American Airlines DC-2 And it takes them 14 days to go from Shanghai to New York to Boston. And they think that's actually quite a quick trip. And you know, that's yep. another thing that today we can hardly wrap our head around, when you can fly nonstop from New York to Sydney. And one of the things you've done so well in this series is that you have had Roland and his friends travel. This is their second time in the United States, because they did dock in New York in your second book. And they've been back to Europe. They've been to Germany. They've been to England. We spent time with them on an ocean liner. Now we've been in China. So we're seeing more of the world in the 1930s than, you know, just Australia or just Shanghai. So did you, yeah. I mean, how did you work out the journey? You didn't actually tell us, if I remember, where all they stopped, but supposing you were flying from Shanghai to New York, how would you do it?
I think you go to Singapore. So that's why they were actually not going from Shanghai, they were going from Singapore. And then it's a hop. It's basically something like 14 stops, where you hop from one place to another until you end up in America. So I can't remember exactly, but what I do when I work out a route or a traveling for Roland is I sit down and I actually map out the route according to what was available at the time, so that I know that whatever I'm saying is plausible. So I can't tell you now, because it's been a couple of years since I actually wrote that book, exactly where they stayed. But I am certain that if I said that that route existed, I actually had evidence that that route existed and they could have done it in 2 weeks. Otherwise, I would have made them get on the boat and travel for 3 months.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not contesting that, but see, part of the reason I mentioned it is that today you would think of them flying from Shanghai east, but yeah. If they were doing it in their time, they would have had to fly from Shanghai west. They would have had to make land stops, because they can't just zip down on Tonga, although even Tonga wouldn't have worked out recently. But they must have flown, you know, basically across Asia to Europe, and from Europe to New York and New York to Boston. Whereas today we would normally consider that, you know, the flight would go the other direction.
So I vaguely remember there would have been a stop in Colombo in Sri Lanka. That stuck in my brain because that's where I was born. And there would have been stops in Indonesia. I cannot honestly remember.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I didn't want you to do that. I was pointing out, you know, that the change in...
It's fascinating. And they'd need changes of clothes for 14 days of travel. Like, now we get on a plane to, you know, this, when I flew to America, I was pretty dark about the fact that I wouldn't be able to change clothes for 24 hours, but 24 hours I was there and I could have a shower in the hotel and change. But 14 days, you cannot remain in the same clothes. So at some point they would have needed to stop long enough to find somewhere to shower and change, otherwise things would be getting pretty grim on the airplane by the end of 14 days.
Well, that's true, although in modern airports, you know, they actually have those facilities. So if you are, especially in Asian airports, as I understand. Anyway, we digress. So let me say that Where There's a Will, which Suari wrote a couple of years ago, which has come out earlier in Australia, it has a British edition. I don't know what other foreign language editions it might have. And now it's come out this month here in the United States from Poison Pen Press, was up for the Ned Kelly Award. So remind us, Suari, because I'm going to be talking to Ian Hamilton, who lives in Canada, after I talk to you, and his book won the Arthur Ellis Award. So this gives us a chance to kind of do a little national English language speaking tour of various awards. Tell us about the Ned Kelly Award, because you've won it before.
I did. I won the Ned Kelly Award for After She Wrote Him, which was published as Crossing the Lines here, and also in America initially published as Crossing the Lines. The Ned Kelly Award is our premier crime writing award. So it's probably the equivalent of your Edgar's. Mm-hmm. And it's It's given for best novel, and then there's a best first novel category. And I think that's all. There isn't a huge amount of categories in our crime writing awards. And it's interesting that awards in Australia have a character. So the other big crime writing award is the Davitt Award, which is restricted to women. And I think the second book in the Roland Sinclair series won the Davitt Award. And so that we only have the two big ones. America seems to have a lot more awards actually out there, but we just have the two big ones. The Ned Kelly is quite an amazing award in that everybody who wins tends to move on to a greater international success. So it is a great platform for taking books out to the world. So it's been previously won by Michael Rowbotham, Adrian McKinty, who wrote The Chain. I think not as many women have won as men, because historically, of course, awards tended to favour men. That's changing. I think I was the first person of colour to win the Ned Kelly in Australia. So hopefully, you know, all of that is indicative of the crime genre and publishing and books generally catching up with the social expectations of the world now. It's been a lag, and in Australia it's been interesting because it's just something that wasn't talked about. Everybody knew it and nobody talked about it. The Davitt was set up originally because women were not getting a look in with the Ned Kelly. So the Davitt was set up as a woman's own award so that female crime writers who make up greater than 50% of the crime writing population would have a chance. And the effect of the Davitt has been that now women are winning the Ned Kelly.
Well, that's terrific. So Ned Kelly, if I recall right, was an Australian outlaw. I love the fact that you gave the award for him.
He was a bush ranger. But he was a very literate bush ranger. So there is a letter that he wrote called the Gerildery Letter, which he wrote while he was waiting to be hanged, which is a beautiful piece of writing that Australians look to. So it seemed very appropriate that Ned then become the icon for Australian crime writing. But he was a bushranger. He was a criminal. He wasn't a detective. He was a criminal. But he was a fighter for social justice. So he was very typically an Irish Australian immigrant who held people up. And he came from a criminal family. So his mother and his sister and his brothers, they were all criminals. And these either criminals or harboring criminals. And they were kind of legendary in Australia. He wasn't quite a Robin Hood figure, but for some reason, Australians have a kind of affection for him because he couched his criminality in a fight against oppression.
Well, it's wonderful that you've been recognized by the Ned Kelly twice. And of course, you have a new book coming out this year in June, which we can talk about before we're done, that may very well sweep more awards. So anyway, let's go back to Roland and Where There's a Will, which is sort of what we were supposed to be talking about here. So they have progressed from Shanghai over 14 days, flying east, or rather west. West, across Europe, and they've landed in Boston. And the question is, why are they making this trip?
Now, in the second book of the Roland Sinclair series, when Roland docked in New York briefly, they stayed with an old friend of his, Daniel Cartwright. And Daniel Cartwright was an interesting figure. He was also a portrait artist, but he only painted himself. And he lived in the Warwick. So he was a man of vast wealth. Roland receives a letter while he's in Shanghai that Daniel has died. And Roland has been named as his executor, and they cannot even bury him until Roland arrives. So Roland has to get to Boston, where Daniel has died, quickly, so that at the very least they can bury Daniel Cartwright and that he can be the executor of Daniel's will. Now, Roland's perplexed because he knows that Daniel has a family, so he has no idea why he's named as executor and why the conditions are so strict that it is absolutely imperative that he personally arrive. And that, of course, unfolds when he arrives in Boston.
It does. So it turns out that Daniel, this all happens before the book actually gets underway. Daniel has not died a natural death. Daniel has been found a body lying across the, or beside rather, the Charles River, and he's been shot. So it looks like a murder.
It is. He's been shot three times. So it's because he's been shot three times, it couldn't be anything but a murder, I suppose. Right. And,
no suicide, no.
So Roland doesn't know that when he arrives in Boston. He's just being told that Daniel's dead in the telegram. And it's only on questioning the lawyers who are in charge of Daniel's estate that he discovers this. And Daniel's a kind of a strange Machiavellian figure in that he seems to have planned everything. So he's planned the hotel that Roland will stay at, and he's left a lot of information for Roland, but he doesn't say anything explicitly. And the reason for that becomes evident as the mystery unfolds, why he needed to be so clandestine and cagey with the information that he left for Roland. But of course, Roland's got to deal with the administration of a will and the mess of distributing a large empire when there are a lot of people who have vested interests in wanting a part of that empire. But on top of that, he's got to deal with his own grief because he's lost a very close friend suddenly and unexpectedly. And in a way that makes him wonder if he could have done more to help him.
Well, you do go into their history together. I don't think we should, because we'll have some spoilers here, but they became friends at Oxford. When Roland went up to Oxford, Daniel was already a student there. And of course, Boston, you know, home of Harvard University, there's some question about why Daniel, you know, brags about or thinks of himself as an Oxford man rather than a Harvard man. Why did he go to Oxford? It was a tough thing for Roland to be sent so far from home and try to adjust. And Daniel really helped him with that. But the other thing, which we do know right away, is that the Cartwright family, which was staggeringly wealthy, lost most of its fortune, apparently, in the stock market crash of 1929. Another brother, Frank, I think his name was entrusted with managing the family wealth, and it was all roses, as it was for so many in the 1920s until the crash came, and then really bad things happened. So there are siblings who are going to question how this will is working out, because there's a mysterious beneficiary called Otis Norcross. Nobody knows who he is. So Roland, I mean, it's tough to be an executor. I'm actually the executor of an estate at the moment. My brother-in-law died, and my brother and I are the co-executor. It is a tremendous amount of work to be the executor, even of a well-organized estate where there are trusts in place and all the rest of it. The paperwork is horrendous. And if there are challenges, if there are, you know, potential beneficiaries who either are excluded or who feel like their share is not fair, or who want to challenge the will and so forth, being an executor is not only draining and difficult, but it can take forever. I mean, it could really take a long time to settle a big estate.
Oh, exactly. And even an ordinary estate, it can take a long time. If there's property, it's always awkward. So I know my background is, before I was a writer, I was a lawyer. So I have a vague understanding of how succession works. And as a result, I'm the executor of my father's estate. He's not he's still with us, luckily. But one of the things that I've always said to him is send a copy of a will, of the will, to everyone who is involved, so that there's no surprises, because where things go crazy in an estate is when people are surprised, when people expect to be remembered, aren't remembered. That's when you see challenges and difficulty. Whereas if people know exactly what's going on, well, any challenges can be made with the person themselves rather than having to harangue the poor executor after the fact.
Oh, sorry, that's not the crime writer speaking, though. That's the beautiful daughter speaking, because that's one of the great staples of mystery of crime fiction is the will. You know, the reading of the will and all the surprises that can go with it and the true hostilities that can come in.
And look, you'll be glad to know that no matter how much I advise my father or anyone else, they still won't do it. For some reason, people like to be very cagey about their wills and don't want to talk about it until it actually, well, they don't ever want to talk about it. They want to leave it to the executor to talk about. And certainly this is what has happened in the Cartwright will. It is a surprise to Daniel Cartwright's brothers and sister who expected to inherit. So what happened with the Cartwright wealth is Frank lost the majority of the Cartwright fortune. In some ways, the crash is a time that really sorted out people who knew what they were doing with finance and people who just were riding an inherited fortune. Frank was riding an inherited fortune. He did what he'd always done, and he lost everything. But Daniel was a little bit more savvy, and he invested well, and he became vastly wealthy during the crash. And so all of a sudden, he, despite being the younger brother, he became the one who was supporting the entire family. And they fully expected that would continue after his death. They almost forgot that the fortune was no longer theirs, that it actually belonged to Daniel. And of course, he had different ideas, and the vast majority of his estate is left to a mysterious figure called Otis Norcross, who nobody seems to know.
The first thing to say that's good is that he actually, well, in this case, you had to leave a will, you couldn't have a plot. But going back to your original comments, it's amazing how many people can't bring themselves to make a will at all. And then it really is a nightmare for everybody. And money goes into channels, often the government, that you don't expect. So, you know, you're a lawyer, I was a lawyer, you know, we're always saying to people, make a will, but it's surprising how few people, many of the lawyers, I might add.
People don't like to talk, especially lawyers, people don't like to talk about money. I don't know whether that's so much the case in America, but certainly is the case in Australia. We still have that old thing where you don't talk about money and you don't talk about religion and you don't talk about how much you earn.
I think previous to the internet, that was true. But since almost all forms of civility have totally broken down, at least here in the United States, and social media and all the rest of it is a large part of it, when it really comes into play is when there are unexpected and, you know, strange deaths like Prince, you know, who are his heirs and what value is the estate? And, you know, if you look back at the 20s and think about 1929 and you look at today with all the billionaires and dot-coms and all the rest of it and an uncharted financial situation going on, you have to ask yourself if we're not going to have some kind of repetition. The Wall Street Journal, I think, has had some very good coverage recently about all the people waving stimulus checks and with nothing on, you know, time on their hands and all, who've plunged into the market to gamble without any idea what they're doing and created a whole bunch of situations, unstable, I will say, situations. And it's difficult to know how. This is the time when actually being conservative may very well pay off once again, in that, you know, you didn't play ducks and drakes or just assume that everything would stay like it is. The world's an unstable place right now. It's a very unstable place financially. And, you know, there are going to be fortunes made and lost.
I think at the moment, there seems to be this real, what do they call it? FOMO, fear of missing out. So people, and I presume the same, it was the same in the 20s. People didn't want to be the only people who seemed not to thrive.
Right.
So they plunged into things like the stock market. And it was okay for a while, because when the stock market is ridiculously buoyant, it doesn't matter that you've made a bad investment. But then when a correction comes, those people fall off very quickly. Daniel Cartwright was clever. And he was, and it was interesting in that when I was looking at that family, it was almost the opposite to Roland's family. Wilfred is the manager of their family's finances, and he's the eldest son. He's taken on that mantle naturally, and he's managed to expand the family's wealth. In the Cartwright situation, it happened in exactly the opposite way. The eldest son took over the family finances and lost everything, including the family home. And it was the youngest brother who stepped up to be the provider, which is something that Roland doesn't have to do. He doesn't have to be the provider.
No, he doesn't. But, you know, let's also remember that a huge amount of the Sinclair money is really tied up in land. I mean, you know, in your, I think it was your third book. I think it was the third one. Isn't that the one where we go out to sort of cowboy country? And I think it is. Anyway, you know, yes. there's a huge amount of property, agriculture, that kind of thing as part of the Sinclair fortune. It's not all paper. It's not all stocks and whatever it is. And so that's probably harder to dislodge even in the event of a crisis. Land is still valuable. People still have to eat, you know. So
a lot of big farms went under in the Depression. A lot of farmers and a lot of and what happened was that the savvy farmers or the good businessmen just bought them up and became bigger. So they became vast land barons, which is exactly what Wilfred has done. He stepped in when a farm has gone broke, and he has had the backing because he already has land. And it's one of those situations where they say, you know, the rich get richer and the poor lose everything. So it was that sort of situation. And I think there's a funny kind of balancing with Roland and Wilfred, in that Wilfred amasses wealth and Roland seems to distribute it willy-nilly. They seem to be opposing forces, but they have come to an equilibrium that they both allow each other to do what they do.
And they haven't run out of money, because that whole equilibrium could change dramatically if the money all disappeared. But right now, we're still okay, and we're marching slowly. One of the great joys of this series is that we're marching very slowly through the 1930s, and we're looking at the rise of fascism, the lure of communism, you know, the world moving towards destabilization. I have learned so much working on this series with Solari, because I think in America we're much more European oriented towards Nazi Germany and so forth, and we don't really appreciate what the Australian and New Zealand, what it was like for them, or even the First World War. I was actually, my last trip to New Zealand, Solari, was the Anzac anniversary. And, you know, that's a very, very powerful thing that has virtually no meaning here in the United States. You know, Gallipoli was not our fight. So I think, you know, as a global view of the 1930s, your series has been remarkable. You take off when the Franny Fisher books end. And I think there's a good reason why Carrie quit right before, you know, they end right before the crash, and you give it a little, and then you carry on. But they're wonderful to read together to get a picture of Australia, you know, after the war. With to be fair, she has a lot of echoes of World War I in her books, you know, the Franny Fishers. And then with you, we're learning a lot about the 1930s. I love the fact that crime writing is becoming so global, that it's not just an American or a British, you know, interest, but we're finding original fiction now rising in all countries, which I think it's great. Let me talk to you for just a moment before we take questions about Boston, because you've had a lot of fun. You've moved them from Raffles Hotel to the Copley Plaza. And you also take us on a tour of Mount Auburn Cemetery, which, as I understand it, is where all the real Boston Brahmins, you know, tend to be buried. It's almost like a tourist attraction. So, you know, have you spent any time in Boston, or is this just your kind of wish list for Boston? No.
It's a wish list. It's not yet. I haven't got to Boston yet, but I will. I'd love to. I have Boston in my imagination. I'd love to see how the real Boston compares. I was really lucky in that I have a friend who's American, who's a Harvard man, and he lives in Australia now. But I was communicating with him the whole time I was writing this book, to try and make sure that I had the sense of place correct, and to, you know, to get things right, like, you know, how long it takes to get from one place to another.
Yeah.
And it's those little things that can actually be really off-putting in a novel if you get it wrong. If you misinterpret by looking at a map how far some place is. And also getting an idea of what are the particular, you know, sites or the particular hidden mysteries of place, as well as, you know, understanding what a Boston Brahmin is, and how that whole East Coast society works. Because in Australia, of course, we don't have that. We have, you know, we have our upper classes and our working classes and so on. But Australia is a newer country than America. Well, the Western part of Australia is a newer country than America. So we haven't actually established those as firmly as they seem to be established on the East Coast of America. So it took Larry to sit and explain to me that how the Boston Brahmins worked and how it wasn't actually necessarily related to wealth, and how the rest of society looked upon that, and things like accents. So it was wonderful to actually have a local to tap into, to try and do Boston justice. But the short answer is no, I haven't actually been there.
Well, you do a wonderful picture of painting it. Of course, I chuckle when you talk about America being so much older, because, you know, compared to Europe, we're just, you know, it's hardly any time at all. So, but Boston, probably Charleston, South Carolina are the most, you know, Brahmin, so to speak, or the most old America sort of thing. And oddly enough, when I went to San Francisco is structured socially when I went off to university there. At the end of the 50s, San Francisco was not dissimilar from Boston or from Charleston, but then, you know, the whole Haight-Ashbury hippie thing came and kind of blew apart San Francisco. But there were very old families there, a lot of them with Spanish land grants and so forth. And so, you know, as compared to, say, Chicago or some other American cities, there's a real difference. But I thought you caught the whole Boston thing very well, and it's really an interesting story. And I'm trying to remember, this title is the one that you and I came up with, but originally you had a different title for this book. What was it?
Well, in Australia and Britain, it's called A Testament of Character. So I think the idea was, you know, when we the word testament is something that's used more commonly in Britain and Australia. A phrase like a testament of character is not unheard of here, and it's not particularly unusual, so it fitted for the title. But I think for an American title, it didn't convey as easily what the book was about.
Well, and it's a springboard too, where there's a will, you know, there's almost a forward momentum. I have to say that I actually ripped that title off from Rick Stout, but titles fortunately are not copyrightable, so. So there we are. Patrick, do you want to pop back in and see if there are any questions from people who might be watching?
Certainly. Yeah, let's see here. Yes. Let's see. Well, Nellie has a question. What drew you to the mystery genre in the first place? Have you always been a fan?
I possibly was without realizing it. So I wouldn't have ever called myself, before I started writing, I wouldn't have called myself a mystery fan, but I did tend to read mystery books. I my favorite books were things like Patricia Cornwell. Even the books that I read that were historical fiction were mystery based. But I didn't actually acknowledge it in that sense until I started writing. And when I started writing, I wasn't writing mystery. I was writing sort of mythological epic adventure fiction and YA. And it was my husband who suggested that I write a murder mystery because everyone likes a good murder, were his words. And so I tried that. And it just was natural. It just fell naturally. So once I was looking at the Roland Sinclair series, it just seemed to be a really natural way to talk about other issues. So with the Roland Sinclair mysteries, I really am talking a lot about political and social dynamics in the 1930s and parallels with today and things about and questions like what makes a person fight for something and how do we choose the causes for which we fight. And it seemed to me, especially after I started writing the first book, that it was a very natural genre in which you could have a conversation about bigger issues. And so I very quickly became a mystery writer, not only with the Roland Sinclair series, but with everything else I write. Now it just seems like, why else would you write? Why would you write anything else? The mystery genre offers me everything that I need as a writer to talk about the issues that mean a lot to me, to develop the characters that I can fall in love with, that I hope readers fall in love with, to explore the world, not only now, but in previous eras, to visit situations that I would never be a part of and see what happens. So for me, it's just a really exciting genre in which to immerse yourself.
So let me add that over time, I've brought Suhari's books to the attention of several authors, and I can tell you, real fans of Suhari's work, Ann Perry, Reese Bowen, and Hank Philippi Ryan, who's a new one, I think particularly with this book, and has either talked or will be talking to Solari about, which would be really good because Hank lives in Boston, so she knows Boston and can discuss it in ways that I can't. But you can see that that's a wide range of authors who really appreciate what Solari's done. She writes about immigration. She writes about division and politics. She writes about social class. She writes about families. I've always been with P.D. James, who, feels that mystery is like the highest form of exploring society, that you can do it better in a crime novel than in most other things. Andrew, go ahead.
What the crime novel does beautifully is it allows you to talk about something while not delivering a polemic. So the center of the book is of course the murder mystery and the puzzle that goes with that, but it allows you to talk about things in a way that isn't preaching at people, because they can actually see how it unfolds in something that's about life and death.
Let me just add too, it doesn't have to be a murder mystery. There are other forms of crime fiction. You can have a spy novel, you can have theft or robbery, you can have forgery, you can have any number of things that power crime fiction. Murder mystery is the one we most often think of, but it really doesn't have to be that.
Yep, exactly. Right. I think the third book is more about a kidnapping.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just conflict, high conflict situations, right?
I've always remembered Sue Grafton in one of her very best stories when she was writing Kay, she started out writing Chaos for Kidnap, and she was really excited about it, and she moved along and it was doing great until she suddenly remembered that kidnapping was a federal crime and there was no way that her private eye could actually work the case. So she had to toss out the whole thing and start over again, and it became Chaos for Killers. So, you know, it is possible.
Oh, wow.
She was always so funny talking, you know, telling stories about herself, but that's one of my very favorites. But so it points out that, you know, you can, in fact, focus on something besides a murder, given the proper investigator for the kind of crime it might happen to be, and see where it takes you. Right.
That's great. So it originally was Chaos for Kidnapping, yeah, or Kidnap?
Yep. She threw away 170 pages of a perfectly good book when she recognized that Kinsey was not going to be able to investigate the kidnapping. Oh, I loved it.
Let's see. Mary would like to know. She says, I love your books. Relative to your writing time, how much time do you spend researching for historical accuracy?
I have an interesting way of researching. I research as I go. So I don't actually do a block of research before I start writing. I just start writing. And when I find something that I need to know to keep writing, I look for it. I look for the answer. And what that means is that my research is really targeted. I know exactly what I'm looking for. And so it's probably quicker than someone who does a block of general research before they go into the book, because they may not know exactly what answer they're looking for because they don't know the questions yet. So it's really hard to answer how much time I spend researching. What I will say is that once I start writing a book, I become kind of ultra sensitive to anything that might pertain to the story. Any little piece of information, snippet of trivia that comes along my way, I seem to instinctively prick up my ears and gather facts. I hope that's not a too unsatisfactory answer. I can't actually give you a particular time because I write and research at the same time. I have always said to people that, you know, the wonderful thing about writing is that there's no wasted before life, because everything you have ever experienced and seen is material for your work. And whilst I write historical fiction and there's facts about, you know, plumbing in Boston or where the restaurants are or where the hotels were in 1935, there's those sort of facts. A good part of the book is also about knowledge of how human beings behave and how they behave emotionally and how they react to jealousy, to love, to conflict. And that kind of research and that kind of knowledge is stuff that you just gather by being a human being all your life.
So let me add this. Hilary doesn't write just historical mysteries. She wrote a brilliant book called After She Wrote Him here in the United States that won the Ned Kelly Award that we discussed. And in June, the first week in June, she's bringing out a new book called The Woman. Isn't that it? The Woman in the Library. Do I have that right?
The Woman in the Library, yes.
And that's a contemporary crime novel. And like After She Wrote Him, there are metafiction elements to it. So it's really quite different than the Roland Sinclair books. It was fabulous fun to work on with Suari, and I'm really excited about it. I'm hoping that we can bring her here to the United States, but a lot of that's going to be a function of where we are with the pandemic and what, you know, travel and other policies allow. But my dream is to have Suari back at the Poison Pen. When she was here last in November of 2019. Right, you know, relatively before, quickly before the pandemic shut us all down in February of 2020. So it would be wonderful if you're able to come back, but we can't promise yet, can we?
No, but I'm going to do everything humanly possible to make it happen, because I since my last visit to the US, I've been keen to come back. But of course, you know, we came back to Australia to bushfires, and immediately after the bushfires was COVID. So the world seemed to just stop for 2 years. But I think now we're starting to move out, and even Australia, which has taken a very protective approach to COVID, has now got to the stage where we feel like we're ready to move forward, and we understand that, you know, it will result in there being more deaths and being more infection, but we've sort of held it back for as long as we can to get our medical systems and our inoculations and so on ready. So I think, you know, we've got 97% of Australia's vaccinated and so on. So hopefully there's, I think the world is going to start behaving like things are normal again. And hopefully I'll be at the poison pen in June, which I would dearly, dearly, dearly love.
Well, that's my dream too. So Larry will do the work. I will write a check and we'll see how it all works out. But we'd be very excited to see her and talk about this wonderful book. So I didn't want any of you watching this to leave with the idea that Suari is entirely an historical mystery writer, because she has wonderful grasp of contemporary crime, and who knows what she's going to do going forward. I'm not even going to ask her at the moment, but I'm sure she's working on something I don't even know about. Yay. Anyway, Patrick, was there a last question, or should we sign off? We're going to move on to Canada here in a few minutes. We're going to go to Toronto and talk to Ian Hamilton about his Ava Lee series. And it's a wonderful series that runs around the world and in Asia. And this new book is taking place on the Isle of Borneo. And I have to say, I'm glad it's not Tonga. We'd be having an entirely different conversation, tragically, today. So if you like to stay tuned at 4:45, we'll be talking to Ian. And then at 6 o'clock, we're going to talk to Elisa Gardner, and we're going to be in the Wyoming wilderness. So this is a dizzying day of travel. I really love it. Anything else, Patrick?
No, I think that's just about it.
Wonderful. Well, Suari, what a treat to see you, dear. I'm glad you've gone through a lot between the bushfires and all the rest of it in the last couple of years, but you have one of the most cheerful dispositions I've ever encountered. And I know that you've gotten through it with real grace. No, seriously, you do. You're always upbeat.
Well, I think I was born under very lucky stars, because all in all, my life is lovely. There's, you know, challenges as there is for everyone else as well. But, you know, everything balances beautifully, and I have the great privilege of being able to make things up for a living, which is an absolute dream. So it would be very trite of me to complain about anything in my life.
Well, on that cheerful note, let me thank everybody. Remind you that Suari has signed book plates for Where There's a Will, and if in fact she can come in June, you can buy entire sets of autographed copies of the Roland Sinclair book, because we will certainly have plenty of them in stock at the Poison Pen. So get on with the rest of your day, Suari. Thank you so much for taking time to join us. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
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 Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.